Welcome to the What's Up podcast, recorded on the 27th of October, 2016. My name's Martin Black.
Hi, I'm Alistair Bruce.
Hello, I'm William Taylor.
And like normal in our podcast, we're going to talk about some interesting news stories that have come up in the last couple of months, and just sort of give a bit more detail behind them. So we're going to talk about the Schiaparelli landing, let's call it. There's the big Gaia data release, and also some information about Proxima Centauri B and the planets being discovered orbiting around it. So I think we'll start off with the Gaia data release.
Okay, so I think I'm going to natter about Gaia. So Gaia, if you don't know what it is, crikey, I should actually know what the acronym is. I don't know what the acronym is. It's an acronym for a spacecraft. So the Gaia is a wondrous beast of a spacecraft, which is currently sitting about 1.5 million miles away from the Earth, and is measuring the positions of stars to an unprecedented level of precision. It's just had its first kind of, you know, teaser trailer, effectively, of data, shall we say, where they've released some of its early results, which are already surpass anything that's been done before, I think. But Gaia is so the basic idea is that we want to work out the position and distance for objects, which sounds like the sort of thing which you think we should probably know already in astronomy, but actually we have incredibly small samples for where we really know a good accurate distance to any of the stars in our own galaxy. So Gaia is trying to improve that situation by a factor of absolutely loads.
Yeah, the numbers are scary for this one.
Yeah, so they've released data on 1 billion stars with precise positions on the sky. So that's kind of, you know, that's the 2D kind of positions. So just sort of where they are if you want to point a telescope at them. And then they've released data of the distance those stars for 2 million stars. So just a small, so in the end, after the mission is finished, after like 10 years, I think it is, they will have data on all those billion for where they are on the sky and how far away they are. And also, more interestingly, where they're moving to. Because we always think of the stars as these wonderfully static things which sit there and you can guide a ship by them, as we've known for a while. But actually, they're all moving around and everything's shifting. So over time, it will change. And Gaia will give us that, which is just awesome.
So this is the time you get to say it's an order of magnitude better than it was before, because it was two, Hipparchus.
I think Hipparchus was a few hundred thousand objects.
Yeah, so a few hundred thousand all the way up to a billion, which is a couple extra zeros in there, which is very nice.
Incredible.
So, yeah,
it's a huge increase.
And then I think the key here is parallax for a lot of these objects as well, because distances, even local distances in the Milky Way, are a pain. So if you do the camera one, camera two thing, where you close one eye and close the other, and you can see nearby objects move relative to the distant stuff. So Gaia's precision just means we're going to get distances for a huge amount more objects, which just means we'll pin down a lot more of what's actually going on in the stellar neighborhood, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Which it's the thing I find so exciting about Gaia is the fact that it's not, it has an impact on just studying the stellar, you know, where are the stars. But we use kind of distance ladders in astronomy. So if we're trying to work out how far away something really, really, really far away is, we kind of use what we know nearby, and then we extend that, and it's sort of like steps. You sort of work from one known thing to another known thing to, and you extrapolate. If you've got the first bit slightly wrong, then you can be quite a long way out when you get to the far distance bits, which means by knowing where everything is within our galaxy to a great precision, you learn a lot about our galaxy, but you also completely, you potentially can significantly affect it, or any area of science.
Can you remember some of the rungs on the ladder? The
Cepheids.
Cepheids. So they're variable stars that you can measure. You can do them out to next few galaxies nearby. Mm-hmm. You've also got rulers. You know, you would use them right way down at the bottom of the ladder there. Not too many things you can use an interstellar ruler for. Then you've got parallax is quite good for very nearby stuff, because that's the motion of the Earth around the sun, makes things nice and good. And then you have to start using supernovae and spectroscopy and redshift surveys, that kind of thing. But sort of everything assumes that you know, you calibrate some of your measurements based on what the lower down rung was on your ladder. So I guess that's why we call it the distance ladder. But
you've got to know how big your ruler is, and then how many rulers it is to
nicely put. Yeah, exactly.
And if you've mismeasured your ruler, then
you're in serious trouble, and that's what Gaia is doing. And I mean, just an immediate kind of, oh look, this is causing a problem. There was a paper about some objects which I've been partially involved in studying, which we were looking at stars which vary in brightness over time, and they appear to throw off a load of sort of mass effectively every now and again. They kind of go, ooh, and kind of, that was a shrug, by the way, and they throw off a chunk of matter. And the trouble is that actually they found that they were in this new catalogue, and they're not as far away as we thought. And the result of this is the fact that actually they don't lose quite as much matter as we think. And, you know, that's just one like tiny example. But there's going to be so many areas where we go, oh, you know what, actually, we need an insight.
We were a little bit wrong, and that has a little bit of impact. Yeah. And then that tweaks this number, and oh, no, that means that that's not quite right. And it's that kind of cascade effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just need lots of time, because basically, as Ali's saying, you kind of do this blinking, you know, our classic interpretation of parallax is blinking, but what we do here is you go to one side of the sun and then to the other side of the sun. So rather than your eyes being a few centimeters apart as they are on your head, you're now two astronomical units apart because you're on either side of the sun. But it means we have to wait 300
million kilometers.
Yeah, so a lot. You have to wait sort of for each orbit before you can get those measurements. So that's why it's going to take ages to get the full data release. But
and so then you also have to bear in mind that everything in the universe is moving as well. So it's not just that you can measure parallax, it's that every star has an individual proper motion on the sky. So it will be moving at some point in some direction. And, you know, it's going to be another slew of extra objects that we now have good proper motions for. So sometimes you can find really fast moving objects that don't belong where you thought they did belong. So it can become
for clusters, it'll be great. Mm-hmm. So it's for that sort of thing, you'll see these objects which look like they're part of a cluster, and actually, because of their speed, you'll be able to work out, oh, actually, this thing's whizzing out of the cluster. Maybe it's been thrown out, or maybe it's actually just a foreground thing. It's great.
Yeah. And this is the first of several data releases for Gaia?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the time frames are for them all, but this was... Gaia's been up there for 2 years, but this was data only from the first year. I don't know how often they're going to do releases, whether it'll be every year or what the plan is. We should know, because it's Nigel, who's about three offices down from where we're recording this, is doing a lot of the data processing. So we should go and talk to Nigel. Amongst other people, I should imagine. It's not just Nigel. That'd be a lot of stars for one man.
I know there's a whole team here on site in Edinburgh that's doing a lot of the data analysis. And I'm also right in thinking that a lot of the data, once it comes back to Earth, gets shunted into our computers here.
Yeah.
And a lot of the
various
analysis
places,
is done.
I think, to you know, you want to back up.
Yeah.
As often as you can, but we're one of the places.
I'm waiting for the pretty visuals where you can do like a fly through of a super accurate, you know.
Well, that's already out. So there's a piece of software you can download from one of the university partners.
Gaia Sky.
Sky. And that lets you basically fly around through the, and it's not just a simulation. It's some of it's simulated, but all the points of light are in the right place and like awesome. The actual right place. And then you can fly around them and it shows you what direction they're traveling in. And it's really impressive.
That's quite cool. And also quite geeky as well.
So extremely geeky. Yeah, yeah. Which is probably why you like it.
Yes.
It runs both in your browser and as a downloadable package for Windows and Mac.
Cool. Mine doesn't have shares in this, incidentally. It is really good, honestly. Go play.
However, Gaia being a very big success, continuing to be a very big success. But I think we also need to discuss the slightly less successful space mission.
Putting my sad face on right now. Curse of Mars.
We have a moment of silence for poor Schiaparelli. So this is a spacecraft launched by ESA, which was going to Mars as part of the ExoMars missions. This is a precursor to the ExoMars mission. I think we've discussed this before in a podcast, possibly in a talk. And Schiaparelli was the lander part of this section of the mission, which was designed to test the landing systems, the parachute system, the retrothruster systems. And it landed just a little bit harder than expected.
A little bit fast.
I.e. making a hole in the surface.
John Davies here calls that lithobraking, where the planet is what stops you from moving fast. A little bit depressing.
Yeah.
And kind of makes you sad because, you know, a lot of people worked for a long time to get this thing working, even though it was only going to run on batteries and it was only going to last for a couple of days or something.
Yeah. It was 2 to 8 days maximum duration on the surface. But the key thing about Schiaparelli wasn't the science it was doing on the surface. It was the science it did as it went through the atmosphere, testing this landing functions for the future spacecraft ExoMars. I mean, Schiaparelli got a piggyback ride on a bigger mission, on a bigger spacecraft called TGO, Trace Gas Orbiter. the job of which was to, and will be doing, is analysing small amounts of gas in the atmosphere of Mars.
That's the expensive bit, right?
Yeah, that was the main part of the mission. Schiaparelli was kind of an add-on to test some of these functions because ESA doesn't have the best track record with landing things on the surface of Mars.
Nobody does. Mars is awful to get to. It's something ridiculous, like 50% of all Mars missions have failed at some point.
Landers, yeah.
I thought it was all Mars missions, if you just take the statistic. I don't, the Russians have never successfully made it to Mars, right?
Well, they were the first to land something, but they only got 15 seconds of data or something.
So there must be a sort of a slightly geeky website that lists everything and what counts as a failure and what doesn't. But yeah, I just
they got a soft landing on the surface in what was it, '70s, early '70s,
precursor to Viking. So
I don't know if that counts as a success or not. I'm not
sure.
I don't know.
In 1970, that counted as a success. Good effort.
It's an interesting measure of success because they said that Schiaparelli was, or so far, that whole mission has been 95% successful. It was just a little bit at the end that didn't work, which is a fairly important bit at the end.
Intriguing.
I think it's an interesting view.
Well, Mars is nasty to get to because there's enough atmosphere to annoy you, but not enough that you can parachute your way down. So you've got to, you know, come in fast, use a drogue parachute, slow yourself down, and then the tiny rovers used to use airbags. Mm-hmm. Can't do airbags for something this chunky, so that's why they were testing this out.
Yeah, Schiaparelli is about 2.5 meters in diameter, so it's a fairly big spacecraft.
That size.
And they were saying that essentially what's happened is everything was working fairly well for a while. Heat shield popped off, parachutes deployed okay, but they detached too soon, 30 seconds too soon, due to a software glitch. And then the retro thruster rockets that are designed to slow it down further before it softly plumps down to the ground. Those fired correctly, but they only fired for 3 seconds when they were meant to go for 30. And the reason for that was because it registered as being too close to the ground because the parachutes had deployed too.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Was this, do you remember the NASA mission that failed because there was an imperial to metric problem? Somebody designed something using metric units in the imperial and there was the crash and burn for something similar. I really hope it's not that.
No, it was a software coding error or glitch that they said that did it. That's what they're currently thinking. I mean, they're analysing the data still. But this is all a test bed for the big rover. So maybe this is arguably, it failed this time, but that's okay because these parts.
But I don't think that was the plan, was it really?
No. Yeah.
But what's good is the TGO is the communications relay for the next one.
Yes.
So the fact that worked is great because it means the rover can at least talk to us.
TGO will do some really good atmospheric science.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually a really impressive mothership. I mean,
and the problem is that Schiaparelli's overshadowed TGO because it's the cool thing that's landing, but actually the orbiter is the main thing.
Yeah, and it's funny how that's ranked as it feels a bit like a failure now because there was a lot of press around it. And then you think, we've discussed this before, but you're thinking about the kind of Rosetta type thing. But let's be frank, the lander didn't really land. It kind of bounced a bit and then we lost it. And
falling was stale.
It got, so it landed more successfully than Thingy Bob.
It did get lucky. I mean, I think,
it kind of bounced off. Because basically the systems they had in place to try and get it to grip they didn't work. Yeah.
I was only sad because I didn't get to say the phrase, we've now activated a space harpoon. Human beings have yet to achieve that particular goal. So I'm a bit sad.
But I think it's intriguing that one is counted as a success and the other, generally most of the public, I mean, from an outreach point of view, from a public engagement point of view, Rosetta was phenomenal. Everyone got really excited.
Yeah.
And I don't quite know why. Maybe it was just the first. Perhaps it was the first, that's the thing. It was landing on a comet. It was different.
Yeah. But, I mean,
I think that there's maybe a danger as well, because Mars has been visited so many times.
We're a bit
that
blasé.
You're assuming you can do it now.
Yeah.
And what are we going to get this
time?
So, and ESA's still sort of learning. I mean, it's a little bit of a shame given that everybody thought Beagle had crashed and burned. And that was the original lander that ESA had been part of. And it turned out it made it, and just sort of one hinge meant that one solar panel didn't open properly. So it arguably had a nicer landing. But what was quite nice is they also have so many probes in orbit around Mars that they were able to take pictures after the fact and see the slightly depressing but also quite cool image of the black scar that was made by this probe impacting it at, you know, was it 5 kilometers a second or something? No, it can't have been that fast because the parachute opened, so it must have been better than that.
But it was still pretty hard landing, though.
Free fall. Yeah, a little bit depressing. But I think they even had the parachute visible in the same image.
Well, what they found is... There's a, you know, since the last pass of, is it Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, I think it was doing this?
Yes.
So they were saying that there's an image of the landing site, the landing area beforehand, which is clean, and then afterwards. And afterwards you see a black spot, which is a few pixels across, which is a few meters across, and a white spot a bit further away, which is bigger. And the size of the white spot kind of corresponds to the parachute size, and the size of the black spot sort of would be a reasonably sized impact crater. So it's reasonable to think that that's probably what it is.
You got to feel sorry for any kind of space science like this because it's all done in the public eye as well. You can't hide.
You can't test
behind closed doors and make mistakes and just get on with it and fix the problem. You've got to just...
And this thing, they did a live stream of waiting for the landing signal to come through, which is what they did for Rosetta.
Yeah.
And I'm not convinced that this is a great... I mean...
I think it is.
Wait, what actually happened? Did they have like loss of signal and then somebody went, quick, cut to commercial? And then that was it? Or
no, they. It was a bit odd because they were trying to do a relay of the signal through a radio telescope on Earth.
Oh, cool.
But at a very. It was only like a ping just to say, I'm still here. And then it stopped pinging. But that in itself was a very experimental technique. So the fact that they didn't get the pings was obviously. In hindsight, was because something gone wrong. But they sort of said, oh no, we weren't sure if this would work anyway. So, you know, we now need to get the data. And they had to wait till, I don't know if it was Mars Express, till something else orbited above before they were going to get any signal anyway. So there's always going to be a delay when they, well, unless the pings had worked perfectly, there was probably going to be a delay.
And given that they then got some sort of ping and got very excited, but it wasn't
that was
right
to say
ping.
TGO was in orbit. I got very excited because I saw that and I was like, oh yeah, it's all fine. And
that was the TGO cheer. And
yeah.
Then, yeah, okay.
Which is awesome. And, you know, they've just put a really impressive piece of equipment in orbit around a planet of tens of millions of miles.
And this all has to happen
away,
on autopilot as well.
Yeah,
you know, it's like 10 minutes away or something currently. Yeah. So yeah, 10 minutes. And by, I think it was only going to take 6 minutes for the landing sequence. So you got to just hope that everything works. And
yeah,
I don't know.
The long live TGO, I think. And
and here's fingers crossed for ExoMars 2020, I think. Might get delayed by a year or two. Interestingly,
there are a few million, I think quite a few million short of the budget.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they were doing this week was going to the European Union to ask for some more money to contribute towards this project off the back of the Schiaparelli success to prove that they could do the landing successfully. And that's not worked. That makes it a lot harder to go to everyone and go, can you give us some more money to do a more expensive version of the thing we just did?
We'll have a bigger crater.
Yeah. Not an enviable job.
It'll be interesting to see what exactly went wrong, because I think they're still crunching through the numbers and they might even get a bit of science out, because apparently it was broadcasting as it was.
And there is the argument that you've now shown where the weak link in that design is, so you won't do that again. So,
yeah.
You know, you've got a result. It's not a failure, it's just a different result than what you were hoping for.
And I think at least TGO's working just fine. Yeah. So I think that's the key. And there was even a slight hiccup with the Juno spacecraft as well.
It was like
a bad day for space science because it went
into Guardian 2.
It was supposed to be doing an orbital correction maneuver and doing some science at one of its close passes. It's only done two since it arrived.
I think so.
Because it's on a big comedy long elliptical orbit that takes like 80 days. And it was supposed to slow its orbit down and then had a hiccup and went into safe mode, which is... the equivalent of you having to reset your router or something, where it's like, something's wrong, we're just going to reboot. And
we've all booted our laptops or PCs in safe mode at some point and gone,
So for spacecraft, it's really scary, because if you have a glitch and it turns out your antenna ends up pointing away from the Earth, you're screwed. You can't talk to your thing. So the safe mode is designed to always keep the antenna pointed at the Earth and go into some kind of a wait and see kind of mode, and so that you've got the maximum chance of getting it back. So obviously, if that works fine. And they're going to have to mess with the orbit later instead, which is a bit of a shame, but at least it's still going. So
it's all okay. We'll see. Okay. Away from the spacecraft to proper science again.
Yeah.
Ali, so, Proxima Centauri.
Did you say Centauri? I've been calling it Centauri, Alpha Centauri.
I've heard different people say, you know,
Okay, I'll admit my Greek is questionable.
It's all right, we've got Alpha bases Centauri. Covered. If you say Centauri and I'll say Centauri, then we're covered.
Well, I say Centauri.
Are we all three different? God, this is just tricky, this. Anyway,
just call it B, so, planet B.
Proxima B is the nickname for this planet. So it's actually the star system Alpha Centauri is quite a bright star. It's very close to the Earth, and it turns out to be a binary star system, but we never get to see it from Scotland because it's always below the horizon.
Binary star being two stars that orbit each other.
Yes, thank you for clarifying. So they're relatively similar to our own sun, so about 10% bigger or smaller respectively, and they're orbiting relatively close. But next door, quite far away, arguably maybe not even part of that system, if it's not gravitationally bound or not, but there is another star, and it's the nearest star that we know of to the Earth. And it's an M-dwarf star, a little red dwarf.
Diddy.
It's very small, 10% the radius, 10% the mass of the sun. And because of its size, it's also not very luminous, but will last for a very long period of time. This is our nearest star. But it's our neighbour.
This is
the next door neighbours.
Yeah.
So Proxima Centauri, it turns out that they'd originally seen a hint that there might be a planet around it in 2013. And they ramped up they wanted to double check, because this is would be quite good news. I'll get onto the statistics of planets in a minute, but so that original blip made everybody quite excited. So then they had what was called the pale blue dot initiative, and not the pale blue dot, pale red dot, because pale blue dot is Carl Sagan's famous video. If you've not seen it, Google. And the pale red dot is a nice shorthand way of saying Proxima Centauri. So they stared at it again with some spectrographs. And they're very good bits of kit. And what you do is you wait and you watch the spectrum of the starlight very, very closely. And it turns out that if there's anything in orbit around that particular star, just the gravitational tug that's exerted by this tiny object compared to the mass of the main star is just enough to put a slight wobble in the star. So you get what's kind of like it's called a Doppler shift. So it's similar to what you do with sound waves. If it's moving away from you, it goes lower. If it's coming towards you, it gets higher. So in terms of light waves, it's bluer or redder, depending on whether or not it's coming towards you. And we're talking silly small speeds to measure. So it's something like a brisk walking pace.
For an Earth-sized planet, around normal star, an average star, it's about 0.8 meters per second change. So
I think
speed.
This one was just under 2 meters per second change or something.
It's 8 centimeters, I think.
Okay.
So this one,
you're thinking of Jupiter.
Basically, the signal is bigger. If your planet's more massive, the signal is bigger. And if the planet's closer in, the signal is bigger. So it turns out that this planet's not incredibly massive. But what's really interesting is they watched the star wobble, and they've now confirmed that there has to be something of at least 1.3 Earth masses within a very small distance of the star. But the star doesn't barbecue the planet outright, because it's such a low luminosity object that you can get really close to it. So it's something like 5% the Earth-Sun distance. That's how close in this planet is, and it has a period of just 11 days. But it's now confirmed. So our next-door neighbour literally has a planet going around it, which is quite nice.
And I'm going to use this word very, very sort of loosely, but in a habitable zone.
Yeah.
Well, is it temperature habitable?
It's temperaturally habitable. But there's a load of reasons why it's probably not habitable at all.
I would have guessed radiation would be bad.
Well, there's a whole bunch of caveats. Yeah. So the habitable zone thing, it's what's called the equilibrium temperature. So if you work out where the planet is and how much starlight falls onto that planet, you can work out roughly the range of distance from that host star where it might have liquid water on it, hence habitable. So that's a little bit loose. If you have an atmosphere, that can make it more or less habitable depending on how thick your atmosphere is. But generally it is sat in where this habitable zone would be, but there's a whole bunch of uncertainty still. So the mass is only a minimum mass, because radial velocity method on its own doesn't guarantee that you know everything about the object. You know it's there, and
you need Gaia, it might help.
Gaia
genuinely might
help
if it's
be able to, So okay. It turns out there's an inclination effect. So if a star is orbiting completely face on, the planet is going face on around the star relative to our line of sight.
Looking almost like a bullseye.
Yes, you wouldn't see anything in the radial survey data because all the wobbles would be happening up and down the way, and you can't measure that with the light that's coming towards the Earth. So if it's completely along the edge of the line of sight, edge on record style, then you get maximum signal. And that's why they have a minimum mass, because they know It's not perfectly aligned, or we'd be seeing transits, which we don't. So we don't think there's transits happening. So it's definitely some kind of inclination, and that means the mass of the planet has to go up and up and up the more you incline the system. But we don't actually have a way of pinning that down yet. Mm-hmm. So that caveat aside, some other people have been working very hard to assume all the numbers are right in the papers so far and actually work out what its atmosphere might be like and its composition. And so there's lots of fun and there's lots of error bars and loads of room to do just about anything. But generally speaking, there might be the possibility for water. In fact, there was one paper that suggests it might be quite likely to have water on it, mm-hmm. given density and calculations. And yes, it all sounds a little bit wishful, I think. But we're going to have to go back.
They've got enough backing to point a large radio telescope at the star as of, I think, this week or next week.
Oh, yeah.
They're pointing it to try and listen for signs of life, i.e. Yeah. Is there little aliens sending it radio signals there?
Well, I'm all for that. That's fine. So I guess the other caveat for it being habitable is that these little red dwarf stars are not friendly to sit around. So this star is tiny compared to our sun, but it's got more X-ray output, or a very similar X-ray output as our massive star is compared to this.
I think it's because there's less atmosphere, isn't it? So you see effectively your... No, is that, I was going to say, I think there's less blocking of the core of the star.
Well, it's also covered in star spots as well. So our sun has the odd sunspot and it burps stuff in our direction. There was an aurora alert just a couple of days ago. Definitely not caused by a lawnmower. The star spots on these little things, because the atmosphere is the upper layers are all convective. So it really dredges up stuff from the bottom of the star where things are fusing, and you get way more activity on the surface. And the end result is that the solar wind that the planet would be experiencing is about 2,000 times worse than the Earth. There was an estimate of that. And on top of that, you've got the increased X-ray emission and the possibility that your atmosphere might literally get stripped. So if you want to be habitable, you really want to be stable for as long as possible. So if your atmosphere is in trouble like that, then it maybe doesn't bode well for it.
There's also
mean it's not possible, but
there's this sort of tidal locking issue as well, isn't there?
Although you can fix that. So tidally locking means if you get close enough to the thing that you're orbiting, your face will eventually sort of stop changing relative to the star. Mm-hmm. So you always point the same bit of the object towards the star. So this happens with our moon. Wobbles slightly, but mostly we only ever see that one face of the moon because it's tidally locked.
And Mercury?
Mercury has a very slow retrograde thing. So
I think it's locking.
Right, it's in the process of locking.
But isn't it in a weird 2-1-3-2 resonance or something? It's doing something a bit weird, Mercury. But if it was a bit closer, it would have eventually stabilised and tidally locked. But the end result being that if you're getting barbecued on one side, then you need a really good atmosphere that's able to convect away a lot of that heat to the backside of the planet so that you don't get completely cooked.
Yeah, which potentially means amazingly strong winds.
Yeah.
We've got this kind of continually dark side.
So I tell you what, to be able to see just a picture of this thing would be amazing. And I guess that's getting to the bigger picture, is why it's a good story, is that statistically speaking, we now know enough about exoplanets. There's, I think, 3,300 odd official confirmed things according to NASA. But we know enough about the statistics that on average, for every star you can see in the sky, there will be a planet. It's a equal amounts roughly to... doesn't mean every single star that you see has a planet, but it means there's a lot of planets out there. Yeah. And the fact that the very closest star to us has one is interesting.
Yeah.
Because if we ever get off our butts and decide to start going and having a wander, so this was the Starshot initiative. Mm-hmm. This is something we could maybe talk about another time. But
talked about it in episode 3 or 4.
That was a long time ago.
Well remembered.
So this was the high speed tiny probes. Send them really fast, and maybe if you're lucky, in 40 years or something, you'll get a bit of data back from the system.
Yeah, we'd bank on it.
This is the nearest star to us, so it's the perfect new target for testing if we can get our telescopes good enough to see interesting things about the planet, which is really difficult to do. So stay tuned. And the other thing is, if you're going to send something interstellar, then that's the right place to point it.
Yeah, it's where we're going to go first, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're going to go anywhere, and now suddenly we know there's at least one interesting object worth going to look at.
Yeah. I ain't confident SETI's going to hear anything, though.
No, really. And there might be much more interesting candidates in the years to come, I think, as we build. As you say, we've only got 3,000, which sounds fantastic, but consider that Gaia's measuring 1 billion stars, which is 1% of our entire galaxy. There's going to be a lot more planets, and
this is at least a billion planets for that equivalent
it
thing.
Does. So, that's the amazing thing, yeah. And some of them will look a lot more like our own.
Yeah,
probably.
It's just a big number game, isn't it? sooner or later you're going to find something similar. I mean, there's enough stuff out there, but
as we get better detecting them, we've got more chance of finding the little ones like Earth, as opposed to all the big ones that we're currently finding.
Yes.
The thing
that makes me slightly sad, though,
near
is
into
that,
their star, which have got all these weird problems of
lots of bias there.
But the thing that I don't like pointing out is that this is our nearest star, and it's 4.25 light years away. So at the speed of light, it takes you 8.5 years to say, hi, how are you? We're fine, thanks, if there was somebody in that star system. That's a long time. And there aren't that many stars that are within this sort of bubble around us that on a human lifetime you could get to and back, even if you could reach that speed. So it's, a little bit depressing. But all the more reason to build bigger telescopes, I think.
Yeah. And starships. I mean, that's the next step. Warp drives, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This is officially moving us into sci-fi territory now.
Okay. Well, that's a different podcast, I'm sure. So
I think they exist.
I think we'll stop on the science now. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you all.
We'll see you again.
Goodbye.